Okay, good afternoon. This is Bio 241. It's February 4th, and it's Thursday, and we're scheduled to have a test on Tuesday. Monday. On Monday. On chapters 1, 2, and 3, and 6. Right? 1, 2, 3, and 6. Okay, so we're going to finish up chapter 6 today. But don't leave class early today, just in case I can't finish chapter 6. All right, don't leave early. So here is a sign-in sheet for today. Please sign that. And please don't ask me in a week or two if you can sign a sign-in sheet for today, because today is the time you have to sign it, right? And if you don't sign it, then it's like you not being here, because I won't be able to remember if you were in class or not in a couple weeks, right? So everybody's free to sign the sign-in sheet today for to get credit for today's lecture. Okay. All right, so that's the schedule. This is where we left off last time, talking about... do the next column over, Okay. I'm trying to get 2 weeks for every sheet just to save paper a little bit. I know. Just sign it again. Read the fine print for sure. Okay. All right, so we were looking at different concentrations of solutions and putting a red blood cell in those different solutions and watch the behavior of a red blood cell. And there's only one kind of solution that a cell doesn't change shape in, and what is that? That's an isotonic solution, right? And that's the concentration of salt is about 0.9%, 99% water. The amount of water entering the cell equals the amount leaving, and so this cell doesn't change shape. But the cell will change shape if we put it in a hypertonic solution. All right, so what's happening to that cell that's placed in a hypertonic solution? How do we talk about that? It's crenated. That's the proper term, right? Crenated. So for sure, you could say shrinking or shriveling or whatever. You can say it looks jagged and shriveled up. This is true, but you know what? Those won't be on the test. The key word that will be on the test is crenation, right? Okay. What about the cell over there that's in the hypotonic solution? What's happening to it? It's swelling, but what do we call that process? It's going to actually swell so much, it's going to break. It's hemolysis, that's right. Hemolysis is the key word. And I can't really show you a hemolyzed cell on the slide because it doesn't look like anything. It's all blown up. It would just look like, you know, cherry Kool-Aid or something. There's nothing to show. So you maybe noticed that in lab when you tried to find hemolyzed cells underneath the microscope, you couldn't find any because they're all blown up, right? The remnants of a cell are so small, or the leftover remnants of the cell are so small, you really don't see them with a light microscope. Okay, so you should know how that goes. Now, do the above processes qualify for osmosis? This is a good review question. Is osmosis happening here, or is this just diffusion? Osmosis. What are the three criteria that have to be obeyed in order for something to be osmosis? What's the first thing? Diffusion first. Yeah, diffusion. Don't forget, that's a loaded term. What does diffusion mean? No, it doesn't have to be a membrane for diffusion. Diffusion means what? From high to low. And now, what does that mean? Does it require energy or no energy? No energy. So, diffusion is no energy, movement from high to low. I guess that's diffusion, kind of in a nutshell. All right. What's the second criteria? Yeah, it's got to be the solvent molecule. And in this particular system, what's the solvent molecule?
Water.
And is that the one that's moving? Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so the first two criteria are met. So far this is looking good for osmosis. Now what about the third criteria? It has to be the diffusion of water across what?
Semi-permeable
membrane. And is that what's happening here? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how could you convince me that that's a semi-permeable membrane? Yeah. But there's an osmotically active particle. What is not moving across the membrane? Oh, no, water is moving across. Yeah, what is not moving across? The salt, for instance. Right? So this is a selectively permeable membrane because water can go across, but salt can't. And since salt can't, we say that it's osmotically active. It's going to change the shape of the cell when water moves back and forth. All right, so is this osmosis that we're looking at here? Absolutely, because it's diffusion of water, diffusion of water across a semipermeable membrane. That's osmosis. Yeah.
What is that opposed to? Like?
That just it means that it's got to be a membrane of some kind. And biological membranes, you know them to be phospholipid bilayers. In lab, you have a membrane, but it's just some kind of plastic material.
Oh.
Okay, I don't know if you've done the diffusion experiment or dialysis in lab yet. Right, that's a membrane. It's just not a biological membrane. And to be selectively permeable or semi-permeable, it means some things go through, but not everything. And I think in lab, you saw water go across, but not starch, for instance. Okay. Some things get through and some things don't for selectively permeable. So to answer this question, yes, and then you should be able to dissect the reasons why it is osmosis. Okay, so water concentration or solute concentration in the body is highly regulated just to maintain cell shape, but to maintain what? Just generally homeostasis. Blood osmolality is maintained in a narrow range right around 300 milliosmolar. All right. If dehydration occurs, there are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus. That's a part of where's the hypothalamus at? It's part of your central nervous system. All right. That sense changes in concentration of solutes or changes in concentration of water. And if there's dehydration, the hypothalamus will stimulate the release of antidiuretic hormone. Now, what do you think might be the response to antidiuretic hormone? And a good way to think of that is to think about a diuretic. What does a diuretic do?
Removes fluids.
Yeah, removes fluids from your body, right? Makes you pee. What does antidiuretic hormone do?
Keeps you from peeing.
Yeah, keeps you from peeing. Maintains water inside your body. All right, and so if you maintain water inside your body, well, how does that relate to dehydration? That subtracts from dehydration. It's a nice negative feedback mechanism. It maintains water balance, right? So ADH causes a kidney to conserve water and to increase thirst. All right, so here's a little flow diagram, which is an exam figure. And I think I tell you it starts with dehydration. When you become dehydrated, what happens to your blood volume as you lose water from your body? It's like taking air out of a tire. What happens to the amount of air in that tire if you take air out?
Decreases.
Yeah, it decreases, right? So when you're dehydrated, blood volume decreases. That can be quite dangerous. The plasma osmolality increases. That means your plasma gets more salty as you take water out of it, right? And what part of the body can monitor that? That is the hypothalamus, because there are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus. And fortunately, the hypothalamus is very close to the pituitary gland, in particular the posterior pituitary. There are nerves that go directly from the hypothalamus into the posterior pituitary, and they release ADH. Antidiuretic hormone goes to the kidneys. It's a hormone because it goes through the circulatory system to the kidneys, and the kidneys respond by resorbing water from the kidney tubules. And you should be a little bit familiar with kidney tubules because in anatomy, we talked about the vascular elements and the tubular elements of a nephron. So water is resorbed from the tubular elements and placed back into the vascular elements of a nephron. All right, and when that happens, we call that water retention. But what happens to blood volume as you resorb water from the filtrate? All right, it feeds back here and that increases your blood volume, right? So we see that the response subtracts from the stimulus, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. Also, the osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus not only trigger the release of ADH, but it will also give you the sensation of being thirsty, and if you have water available, hopefully, right, then you will drink some water, and that will also increase your blood volume and increase your blood volume and decrease your plasma osmolality, bringing you back to the set point, right? So this is a nice homeostatic mechanism. All right, so do you all see how this works? It's just a really nice flow diagram. Okay. Membrane transport. carrier mediated transport, there may be molecules that are too large to diffuse across a membrane. They can't fit through whatever pores or spaces there are in the membrane. Or maybe these chemicals just have the wrong nature to them. What kind of molecules can diffuse through the cell membrane just by their nature?
Inorganic.
Okay. Inorganic or organic? Nah, quite right.
Nonpolar.
Okay.
Nonpolar.
The ones that can diffuse, or the ones that cannot diffuse. No, wait. I forgot what I asked. The ones can diffuse. Okay, the ones that can diffuse, you're right, are the nonpolar ones, right? Because the interior part of the phospholipid bilayer is nonpolar, so only nonpolar molecules can get through the membrane. Right. So, if molecules, where do I have it here? If they're polar, they can't get across. They can't get through that lipid bilayer. So there has to be some kind of other protein that will allow them to do that. And we're talking about carrier-mediated transport. In order for a molecule to go across the membrane, they actually have to bind to the membrane protein before they're transported across. And there always has to be a relationship between a transporter and the molecule that's being transported if binding occurs. All right? And so there has to be an active site on the carrier protein that binds the molecule that's being transported. And the way that we understand this to happen is by the shape of the molecules. The shape of the molecule that's being transported, when it binds to the carrier protein, has to bind to a shape that's complementary. Right? So, for instance, if the molecule that's being transported is circular, what does the binding site have to be? Can it be square or can it be triangular? No, it has to be what? Kind of circular in nature so that the molecules can bind. Or, for instance, if the molecule is triangular shaped, what about the binding site? It has to be triangular in nature as well. It can't be circular, can't be square. All right. So the shapes of the transporter molecule and the molecule that's being transported have to be complementary. Just like when, for instance, two strands of DNA come together, there has to be that complementary shape that allows two strands of DNA to come together. All right, so carrier-mediated transport exhibits these following characteristics. And we have a graph that we can use to explain some of these characteristics. And this graph is a plot of the rate of transport of this particular molecule, X, right, the rate of transport versus the concentration of that molecule. Right, so it's increasing as you go from left to right. And the rate increases as you go from bottom to top, right? So if you were going to draw this out, for instance, in lab or something, I would actually have you draw little arrows over here so you know which way the direction is increasing, right? So it increases if you go up. It increases if you go to the right. Okay. Well, carrier proteins exhibit specificity for a single molecule. So let's talk about a molecule that's transported by a transporter protein in the membrane, and that would be glucose. Right? And glucose, can you remember kind of what does glucose look like? Does it look like, you could think of it as a long chain, but what does it really like to do? It likes to form a cyclic compound. It sort of looks like a stop sign, right? A six-sided figure. All right? So that means that the carrier molecule has to have a binding site that looks kind of like what? The reverse of a stop sign in order for glucose to bind to it. If a molecule doesn't have that shape, it won't bind. So this carrier protein is very specific to that shape. Only molecules that have that shape can be transported. So glucose will work fine, but can you think of another molecule that has a similar shape? Okay. Ribose might have a similar shape. Yeah. That's a 5-carbon sugar. One that has even a more similar shape will be another 6-carbon sugar, like, for instance, galactose. Right? That's one of the ones on your diagram. You don't have to know the difference between glucose and galactose. Right? They're just monosaccharides, so they have a similar shape. So galactose can be transported by the same molecule as well. But, for instance, how about a fatty acid? Can a fatty acid be transported by a glucose transporter? Their shapes are just too different. Or, for instance, a steroid. A steroid will never fit in the active site for a glucose transporter, right? So specificity is defined by the shape of that particular compound. But if there's a molecule that's similar in shape, it can compete for the transporter. So galactose can compete for the glucose transporter because why? It's almost the same shape, right? It can trick the transporter into thinking that it's a glucose to a large degree. All right, so we call that competition. We call that competition. So there can be competition among substrates, for instance, galactose and glucose, if they have nearly the same what? They have to have nearly the same kind of shape in order for competition to take place. And then the third characteristic is saturation. In the membrane, there's just a finite number of transporters, and when those transporters get bound to the glucose, then the transport across the membrane stays at that particular level. Okay? Even though the concentration of glucose might be increasing on the outside of the cell. And when a transporter gets saturated, we say that it is working at the transport maximum. So if we increase glucose concentration, those transporters can't transport any more glucose across the cell membrane no matter what. That's T sub M. A way of thinking about that is, let's just say we were going to have a field trip. Where would we like to go for a field trip? I don't know, like Bolsa Chica or something? Go look at some birds? What the heck, why not? All right, and we're all going to go there by taxi, but a taxi can only take one student. All right, and so before class, I have 50 taxis. No, let's say I got 20 taxis waiting outside. Okay, how many students can be transported at one time?
20.
Only 20 students, right? All the taxis get saturated. Even though we have more students in class that need to get to Bolsa Chica, that's the maximum amount. Right, if we want to increase the rate of transfer to Bolsa Chica, what would we have to do? Yeah, we have to get more taxis. All right, so cells can transport more glucose, but what would the cell have to do? It would have to build more transporters and put them in the membrane in order to get the rate of transfer faster. All right, so when you saturate a transporter up with molecules that are being transported, there's really nothing you can do. So if we have 20 taxis, and instead of 50 students in class, all of a sudden we have 1,000 students, will the rate of transfer change? No. It's just what? We have to get more taxis to get people over there, right? All right, so that's what this graph shows right here. All right, so here is the rate of transport. Here's the concentration of X. And you can see that as the concentration of X increases, more X binds to a transporter. We're putting more students in more taxis, for instance. And then when the transporters are all saturated with X, look what happens to the rate of transport. It levels off, right? It cannot increase. This is what we call saturation. This is saturation right here. And that happens at T sub M. That's the maximum transport rate. That's the solid line. But we also have a dotted line right here. And the dotted line is, how would you describe the difference between the solid line and the dotted line? The dotted line is, we reach T sub M at a lower rate of transport. And why is that? Because with this particular graph, instead of just one molecule in solution, we've got two. And let's just say X is glucose, and Y is a similar kind of molecule like galactose. And galactose can bind to the active site. And when galactose binds to the active site, what about X or glucose? It can't, right? So if galactose is in that active site, glucose can't get in and it can't be transported. That's why saturation occurs at a lower concentration of X. But that's only if X and Y have what? Very similar shapes, right? Very similar shapes. Okay. So we're going to look at this graph some more. But here is a nice graphic that kind of shows what I've been talking about. Here we have a nice phospholipid bilayer. Here is a glucose molecule. And is glucose polar or nonpolar? It's polar. It's hydrophilic because of all those OH groups. All right, so glucose can't get across the membrane because of this oil layer right here. But cells, of course, need glucose to make ATP, so glucose has to get in the cell somehow. All right, if it can't just diffuse across from high concentration to low, it needs a transporter. Here's a nice transporter protein. So here's a glucose. What about the binding site on this transporter protein? How would you describe the nature of the binding site right here to the glucose molecule? It is? Yeah, it's by shape. It's very nicely, they're complementary. So this glucose can fit into this active site very nicely, right? And when it does, there's something funny that happens. Because the concentration is so high outside the cell and so low inside, there's a lot of energy in this gradient, and it can cause a change in conformation of this protein. So as soon as glucose binds, this protein is going to change conformation. Because what gives this shape to the protein? What kind of bonds are holding it together in this particular shape? What kind of bonds hold a protein in a particular shape? You saw a whole bunch, but mostly it is hydrogen bonds, okay, and ionic bonds. Right, but primarily hydrogen bonds. How strong is a hydrogen bond? Very weak, right? So when we change the nature of this molecule by letting glucose bind to it, this molecule will change shape. And so it was closed to the inside of the cell, open to the outside. After binding to glucose, look what happens to it. It's now closed to the outside and it's open to the inside, changes conformation, it spits out the glucose, and it ends up inside the cell. Nonetheless, all right, so is this active transport or passive transport? It's still passive because you see high concentration on the outside, low on the inside, so it's going from high to low. Another dead giveaway is, if it was active, what would you expect to see on this illustration? ATP being utilized, right? And do you see any ATP here? Absolutely not, right? So this is passive transport. So a way of thinking of this, when glucose binds to this transporter, you don't have to know the name of the transporter yet, okay? Just think of you sitting at your desk taking some notes, and then who's ever next to you, all right, all of a sudden takes their finger and pokes you in the side. What are you going to do? You might hit them, okay, but are you just going to sit there and say, oh, what's happening? No, you're going to move, right? So think of this glucose when it binds to this protein, it's like jabbing it in the side, it's going to change conformation. You would change conformation too, right? Okay, and then the glucose can go inside the cell. So this is a typical glucose kind of transporter. But what can you tell me about glucose? Can it enter the cell at any time?
No.
Do people have trouble importing glucose from blood into their cells? What do we call that disease?
That's diabetes,
right? Okay. Because these transporters can't be operating all the time, because there might be a time when you're in a fasted state where glucose is at a low concentration in the blood, and that glucose should be preserved at that concentration. It shouldn't go into the cell. When that happens, these transporters actually get taken out of the cell membrane. And actually the whole membrane segment right here is recycled and placed into this vesicle. And this vesicle, we didn't learn this vesicle name when we started looking at cells. This one right here is called an endosome. So an endosome is inside the cell in the cytoplasm, and it contains transporter molecules, right, ready to be placed into the membrane. So this is what happens when there is no insulin signal, and this happens when you're in a fasted state. Okay, this cell can't take up glucose. Do you see that? Why can't the cell take up glucose?
Doesn't have any
transporters, and glucose can't get through the phospholipid bilayer. All right, so when you're in a fasted state, all these transporters are in this endosome, but as soon as you start to eat something, what happens to your blood glucose? It goes up. What organ can monitor an increase in blood glucose? The pancreas. The pancreas is going to release insulin. The insulin signal is going to tell this cell right here to fuse this endosome to the cell membrane, and guess where it ends up? Right here. Okay, so insulin inserts the endosome into the plasma membrane, and then it gives this activity to the cell membrane so that it can take up glucose, and what happens to blood levels of glucose then? It goes back down to the normal level. Meanwhile, this cell right here is taking up glucose so that it can make ATP. All right, so the endosome, the job of an endosome is to store membrane proteins right here, but it's also important for routing. It can tell where those enzymes should end up or these transporters end up at, in different important parts of your daily life. Yeah. Absolutely. It can operate, I don't know how fast it can operate. Maybe as high as, I'll just take a wild guess, but I'll have to look it up. Maybe 10,000 times a minute. So it's fast. It's real, real fast. Yeah, very, very fast. Faster than you can see. And it can be reused. And I don't know what the lifespan is of this particular transporter. And it might be that there's different forms, and it might be somebody that has a certain kind of diabetes. Maybe the lifespan of these transporters is so short, shorter than normal. Maybe they operate a little bit and then die, and then the person loses that ability to take up glucose. That could be one reason for diabetes. We'll investigate a number of different kinds of diabetes and the reasons for that. Okay, so here's that endosome. You can see that it's storing the functional components for glucose uptake in the cell. Okay. But that's a passive transporter. You didn't see any glucose. I mean, any ATP. Glucose was only going from high to low. Here's a different situation for a membrane transporter. And here we have calcium that's low inside the cell and it's high outside. And cells like to pump calcium outside of the cell. All right, so here's that phospholipid bilayer. Now, why can't this, why doesn't high calcium just diffuse into the cell like this? Do you see why that is? Okay. Why can't this calcium ion, this divalent cation, enter the cell, go from high concentration to low by diffusion? Yeah, because calcium is a polar compound. It's surrounded with the hydration spheres. Can't get through the phospholipid bilayer, right? It just has the wrong nature, all right? But cells don't like to have any calcium floating around inside the cytoplasm. It likes to kick it out, all right? And going from low concentration to high, what kind of process can you use? Okay, can it be a passive process or does it have to be active? It's got to be an active process. If it's an active process, what molecule are you going to sacrifice to get calcium out of the cell? You need an energy molecule in terms of ATP. You need ATP, right? All right, so here is a different kind of membrane protein. It has a binding site for calcium, right? So calcium moves in, and it has a second binding site. The second binding site is for ATP. And when ATP binds here, it is hydrolyzed, right? The terminal phosphate from ATP comes off, and you're left with ADP. And now what kind of bond is in this ATP between this inorganic phosphate and the ADP when it's in all together in ATP? What kind of bond is that? Is that a hydrogen bond or an ionic bond? What else do you know? Covalent bond. Okay. Well, what is ATP really carrying around with it? What is ATP carrying around with it? Energy, exactly right, right? So there's energy in ATP, right? And it's in the form of chemical energy, so these bonds contain a lot of energy, and that's synonymous with a strong bond, which is a, what kind of bond is strong? Covalent bond. So we have covalent bonds that are holding these phosphates onto ATP. When it gets hydrolyzed, that energy can be released. Right? That a lot of energy, because it's a covalent bond, can be released. So you don't see this on the diagram, but you know what? You probably should draw it in, and maybe next time I make this slide, I'm going to draw it in. ATP goes to ADP plus inorganic phosphate plus what? Energy, right? That energy can be used to make this protein move, turn it into like a motor protein, right? And so now it's closed on the inside of the cell, it's open to the outside of the cell, and calcium then is released to the outside of the cell, moving from low concentration to high as a result of using that energy that was in ATP. So what do we call that? What kind of transport process? Active or passive? active. That's got to be active transport. And the dead giveaway is what? ATP right here. The other dead giveaway is something going from low to high. That's active transport. So that's how a cell gets rid of calcium from the cytoplasm and puts it outside. All right. And this kind of molecule that uses ATP to move something from low concentration to high, we call that a pump. All right. Just think of a pump that's like a well. Probably you all have had gone someplace, and to get water out of the ground, what did you have to do? You had this thing with a long handle, and you had to sit there and crank it. You had to pump water from low to high to get it out of the ground to use it for whatever you wanted to use it for. All right, so this is really a pump. Think of like a little well pump with a handle on it, but the energy source is what? ATP. Here's another kind of pump. All right, a pump, what does a pump do? How does it move molecules from low, yeah, to high, right, against the concentration gradient. So it's an active process. This is the sodium potassium ATP pump. So it's going to move both of these molecules against the concentration gradient. In most cells, there is high potassium inside and low outside. So that's just something you're going to have to memorize really soon, right? Potassium is high inside. Potassium is low outside. Which way will potassium just want to diffuse? Just by the concentration gradient. It wants to diffuse out, down its concentration gradient. All right, here's something else that's crucial in this class. There is a concentration gradient for sodium across the membrane as well. But it's opposite that of potassium. It is high outside, right, and it is low inside the cell. All right, and one of the reasons why that is because there is a membrane protein that can bind potassium and sodium, and it's going to move potassium from outside to inside against the concentration gradient, and it's going to take sodium from outside and kick it outside, also against the concentration gradient. All right, so when something moves against their concentration gradient, what kind of molecule is necessary to kick it out? You need ATP. So is this an active process or a passive process? It's active transport. That's why we call this the pump, the sodium potassium ATP pump. All right, now what you don't see on this diagram right here, which is probably pretty important, it doesn't pump one potassium and one sodium, all right? It has a different number, and it's different for the two different ions. It will pump out three sodiums and only pump in two, okay? That's how this pump operates. Three sodium out and two in. What's the charge on a sodium?
One.
Yeah, one plus one. How would you talk about the charge on potassium? Yeah, it's plus one as well. Okay. So what I want you to begin to see right here is if we're pumping out unequal numbers of sodium and potassium, what do you think is happening electrically to the cell? If you're pumping out more positives then you're pumping in, what's happening to the inside of this cell right here? It's becoming negative as a result of that, right? It's becoming negative. If it's pumping equal numbers in and out, then the electrical charge wouldn't change. But since it's pumping unequal numbers, the charge is slowly going to change across the membrane right here. All right, so that's a little foreshadowing of what we're going to talk about. But before we start talking about electrical properties of the cell, I want to talk about another kind of active transport mechanism. Okay? Active transport always means something is going to go from low concentration to high. Right? And what we've looked at so far, what is the form of energy that we've used to move a molecule from low to high? ATP. Right. Okay. So now we're going to introduce another concept, and that is there's a primary active transport and there's something called secondary active transport. All right, and let's look at this diagram down over here, and let's pretend that this is kind of a plot of concentration along this vertical axis. Concentration along a vertical axis. So here's low concentration. As we move up that vertical axis, it becomes higher concentration. Right? So as something moves from low concentration to high, is that passive or active transport?
Active.
That's active transport. That's going to require energy to get that motion. Going from low to high always requires energy. And let's move a sodium ion from low concentration to high. All right, and I just showed you the sodium-potassium pump. What's the energy source for that? That was ATP, right? So anytime you see a process that's active, moving things from low to high, and it requires ATP, by definition, that's what we call primary active transport. Primary active transport is when you move something against a concentration gradient, and you have to utilize ATP. You use up ATP in the process of doing that. Okay? Well, so now you've used up ATP, and you've got a concentration gradient of sodium. You've got some place where it's high and some place where it's low. What does this sodium want to do? Just passively, what does it want to do? It wants to go back down. It wants to diffuse, right, so that the concentration is equalized. But there are some smart places in the cell that know sodium wants to go back down to the slow concentration, and it just won't let it do it without getting something from the gradient, because there is energy in this gradient. Where did that energy come from? ATP, primary active transport. So that energy doesn't go away. Remember, energy is neither created nor destroyed, can be converted from one form to another. So energy has been converted from chemical energy in ATP to another form of energy that is in this gradient right here for sodium. It can be used by the cell. Okay, and what is it used for? In this particular case, we can throw sodium off this cliff and let it diffuse right down a concentration gradient, but let's couple it to another mechanism. And there could be membrane transporters, some different proteins in the membrane, so that when sodium goes down its concentration gradient, it trips this teeter-totter. And on the other end of the teeter-totter, there's a glucose molecule. Right? So when sodium falls off the cliff, it hits the teeter-totter, what's going to happen to this glucose molecule? It's going to go up a concentration gradient. It's going to go from low concentration to high concentration. Right, so it can move up a concentration gradient. And when it goes from low to high, is that passive or active? When it goes from low to high, that is always active. When it goes from high to low, that's always passive. Things falling down, that's always passive. But going up, like driving up a hill, does that happen automatically? No, you need gasoline. You need energy to do that. So when glucose goes from low to high, that's active transport. But when you look at this mechanism right here, do you see any ATP being used? No ATP being used. Energy is being used. What energy is being used? The energy in the gradient is being used and not ATP. So it is active transport, but we can't call it primary active transport because there's no ATP. So we call this right here secondary active transport. Very important mechanism inside your cells. All right, so secondary active transport does require energy. No two ways about it, because something's going from low concentration to high. All right, but it's not in the form of ATP. It's in the form of a gradient, and in this particular case, a sodium gradient. All right, the other thing that this shows is that when glucose is moved via active transport from low to high, something else has to move too, namely what? Sodium has to move, right? If sodium can't move, then glucose is not going to move either. Just like in this particular case, sodium won't go from low concentration to high unless you have what available? ATP, right? You have to have ATP available for primary active transport. You have to have a gradient, in this particular case, sodium, in order to have secondary active transport operating. All right, so where do we see this in a cell? All right, we're almost about ready, and we're going to rely on what we saw for glucose already. So here we see a nice phospholipid bilayer. Here's a glucose molecule. Can glucose move across this membrane right here? No, it can't. And let's just say that glucose is already high inside the cell, high concentration inside the cell, low outside. Can glucose diffuse from low concentration to high? No. Diffusion goes the other way around, right? So you need energy to get glucose inside the cell. Now, do you see any ATP in this diagram? No, no ATP. So can this be active transport that I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay, but active transport requires what? ATP. You see ATP here?
No.
No ATP. What we're looking at is the motion of glucose from outside to inside the cell. So this can't be primary active transport. This is what we call secondary active transport because what is being used is the sodium gradient. Where did we see sodium at a high concentration? Outside the cell. It wants to diffuse in, right? So there is energy in that gradient. So sodium wants to diffuse in, but there's a special kind of protein. It's got to bind both the sodium and the glucose. And when sodium binds and when glucose is bound right here, that's like doing what? Poking you in the side. You're going to change conformation, right? So now this protein is closed to the outside and it's open to the inside, and now both sodium and glucose can enter the cell. So in this particular case, sodium goes from high to low. That's just diffusion, but there is energy in that gradient. That energy can be used to cause a conformation in this protein, allowing glucose to go from low concentration to high. All right, and that's what this diagram really shows right here. So sodium moves down its concentration gradient, glucose moves up its concentration gradient, and so that's active transport, right? Glucose going from low to high, that's active transport. But do you see any ATP being used right here? No. So can that be primary active transport? No. This has got to be secondary active transport, utilizing the energy in the sodium gradient here to move glucose. All right. Two other ways that we can talk about secondary active transport. Don't forget, secondary active transport requires at least two molecules in order for it to work. The gradient in one is sacrificed to use to move the other up a concentration gradient. So the two different kinds of active transport are called co-transport or counter-transport. I like the term symport or antiport, personally. And it has to do with the directions that these two molecules are moving. Which way are they moving for this particular transporter? In the same direction or opposite directions? The same direction. Both sodium and glucose are entering the cell, so we call that a symport transporter, right? Or co-transport. Both molecules move in the same direction. That doesn't have to be, because sometimes the molecules move in opposite directions, and that's what we would call an antiport transporter, or an antiporter, or another term would be counter transport. And I don't have a picture to show you of this, but in that particular case, sodium would bind from the outside, some other molecule would bind from the inside, and it would just flip back and forth, and they would both move accordingly.
This is just co-transport.
So what you see right here is co-transport or symport, because both molecules are moving in the same direction. Okay. Now, where do we see these mechanisms working together? Okay. Let's talk about diabetes mellitus. One of the clinical manifestations of diabetes mellitus, when your blood glucose goes so high, all right, it gets filtered out by the kidney, and usually the kidney takes all of the glucose that's in urine and puts it back in your body, because glucose is an energy molecule, right? You don't want to lose energy. An analogy I could use for losing glucose in the urine, you don't want to lose glucose in the urine because glucose is energy. You'll run out of energy. Yeah, a good analogy would be if your car, you take your car to the gas station, and what do you put in your car at the gas station? Gasoline, that's energy, right? You don't want to lose that energy, right? If that car had, in an analogy form, if it had diabetes mellitus, you would put gasoline in the car, but also a hole in the gas tank. And what would happen to the gasoline? It would leak out of the gas tank, right? And you would lose that energy. So diabetes mellitus is like that. People are losing energy when they lose glucose in the urine. So the normal individual doesn't lose glucose. Glucose ends up in the filtrate, but it's resorbed, right? It's taken out of the filtrate before it becomes urine. And here is the membrane that does that. And remember, that's called resorption, tubular resorption. Is that ringing a bell from anatomy? Okay? If not, you might have to go back and look at the nephron elements again and see how that moves. All right, tubular resorption. So let's pretend. Here is the kidney tubule right here, and we have glucose in low concentration in the filtrate. And if this fluid continues down the kidney tubules as filtrate, it eventually does what? End up as urine, and it's voided from the body. And it's lost, right? That's a terrible loss. So even though glucose is low concentration, where should it be? It should end up in the blood, right? Because you don't want to lose glucose. You don't want to lose glucose in the urine. You want to get even low concentrations in the blood. So glucose might have to go from low concentration to high concentration in the blood. What kind of process allows things to go from low to high?
Active transport.
All right, so let's see how the kidney tubule works in terms of recovering all this glucose that's in the filtrate. In the filtrate, we have high sodium. Inside the cell, what do we have? Low sodium. So there's a gradient of sodium. What's another way of thinking of that gradient of sodium? It is a energy source. It's a source of energy because sodium wants to enter the cell. We'll let sodium enter the cell, but we'll couple it with this protein right here, which also has to transport glucose, right? So here is a protein that is going to allow sodium as well as glucose to enter the cell using the gradient of sodium so that glucose can go from low concentration to high, right? So what is that process called? Glucose going from low to high is that active or passive transport? That's active transport. You've seen ATP being used right here. No. So is that what kind of active? That's secondary active transport. And remember, different ways that secondary active transport can work. It could be what? Co-transport or symport or counter-transport. But if the sodium and glucose are going in the same direction, that's got to be co-transport. But don't forget, co-transport is really what? Secondary active transport. Okay. All right, so now glucose is high inside the cell. Sodium is entered. How do we maintain this sodium at a low concentration inside the cell? Notice on the other side of the cell, right, we have a typical sodium-potassium pump. So this is a different protein than this co-transporter we have here, this symporter. Right, and don't forget, membranes typically are polar. This is the apical surface. This is the basolateral surface. The cell puts in different kinds of proteins in different parts of the cell membrane. So here is a sodium-potassium pump. It's going to pump sodium out. It's going to pump potassium in. And it's going to use up what molecule? ATP. All right, so how would you talk about this? Sodium going from low concentration to high concentration in the blood. That is active transport, but is this primary or secondary active transport, and why would you call it that?
Primary.
It's primary because you're using up ATP, right? Okay. So that's what happens to sodium. Let's finish the story with glucose. So now we have high glucose inside the cell, and we have low glucose in the blood. What can you tell me about glucose? Does glucose want to go into the blood automatically?
No. In the blood, yeah.
Okay, because things automatically want to go passively from high to low concentration. And what do you need? Can glucose go across this membrane right here? It can't because it's a polar molecule. So it needs some kind of facilitated diffusion molecule, a carrier protein, right, which we saw. Where would you say? Right here. All right, there it is. Let's put that in the membrane. Ah, right here. And now glucose can go across the membrane from high concentration to low by, what, just passive diffusion. But when it needs a carrier protein, what do we call that? We call that
facilitated
diffusion. All right, so now we're not losing glucose in the urine. It's ending up in the blood where it belongs. And this is not a diabetic person. All right. Now, when somebody does have diabetes, there is so much glucose in the filtrate that it saturates all of these transporters in the apical surface of the membrane, right? And when that happens, what happens to the remainder of glucose that's in the filtrate when this co-transporter gets saturated? It just, what we call, it just spills out in the urine because you've saturated these transporters in the kidney tubules, and that's a nice clinical sign for diabetes mellitus is when you have glucose in the blood. When does that, huh? Yeah, it would taste sweet. And when I teach labs, that's part of the urine analysis lab. Okay. Absolutely. That's how it was diagnosed years ago before we could measure glucose.
So are we in a medical?
Yeah. Huh? Yeah, you just taste urine. Okay. There's other chemical compounds that develop in urine as well. I can't believe it. You know, when I was being interviewed to be hired here, I told them that, and they freaked out. They go, "Oh, you can't possibly do that." And one of the people that was on my hiring committee was the physiology lab tech who's actually mixing up the solutions and that kind of stuff, and she almost fainted. But actually, you don't do it with real urine. It would be artificial urine, of course. Okay. But so it's a simulated experiment. All right, so that is primary active transport, secondary active transport, and I still got hired anyway. That's pretty amazing. Okay, so for primary active transport, how does a molecule move across the membrane?
Low to high by ATP.
Low to high, and you got to see ATP being used up for primary active transport. For secondary active transport, how does a molecule move?
Low
to high. And you see ATP?
No.
What do you see? You see a gradient of some kind, like a sodium gradient that's being used up to transport that molecule. Let me see what we're talking about. Glucose?
Yeah.
Wow, let's take a look at this. All right, here, glucose is going from low to high. Mm-hmm. Would you agree that's active transport?
Uh-huh.
That's active transport, but it is secondary because I don't see ATP. Now, what about glucose now inside the cell that's high to low? Is that active transport?
No.
No, and I think that's your question, right? Is that your question? Yeah, that's not active transport. That is, you see it labeled right here, that is? Diffusion. Is diffusion active or passive?
Passive?
It's passive. So glucose can go from high to low as long as there's a way to get across the plasma membrane.
So diffusion has to be passive.
Diffusion is always passive. High to low. Yep. Yep. All right. So guess what? This is an exam figure. Right? So yeah, we talked about this one a bunch. All right, bulk transport. Bulk transport is active transport. It's when the membrane changes shape, it shifts shape, and the way that it does that, there are integral proteins that are embedded in the membrane that are attached to microfilaments and microtubules inside the cell that slide past each other and can put a little pucker in the membrane right here, or an invagination so that materials on the outside of the cell get trapped in this little crease, and then the microtubules, right, form a pouch, and then that breaks away from the cell membrane and forms a vesicle inside the cell. And so whatever was outside that ended up in here now ends up inside of a vesicle inside the cell. So this would be an example of endocytosis, right? And there are two kinds of endocytosis. This is kind of a review for you from anatomy. What are the two forms of endocytosis? What can end up in here?
Pinocytosis
is one, and the other is? Phagocytosis. So this kind of looks like phagocytosis to me because I see particles. Phagocytosis is cell eating. Pinocytosis is cell drinking. The opposite can work just as well. For instance, if these particles right here were part of the secretory pathway, where does that see? How do you think of that secretory pathway? Think of some organelles. What do we got? We've got what kind of organelle can make a protein? Yeah, ribosome. And for instance, the ribosome could be free in the cytoplasm, or it could be attached to another organelle. Like the rough endoplasmic reticulum, right? So proteins made by rough endoplasmic reticulum find their way by vesicular transport into the Golgi body, where they're maybe modified, right? And then packaged into a secretory vesicle. So these proteins right here came from the rough ER, and they're ended up in a secretory vesicle, and then it hops a ride on microfilaments and microtubules to the plasma membrane. It fuses to the plasma membrane, and these proteins are exocytosed right out of the cell. So we call that secretion. Or maybe these are hormones or some other kind of signaling molecule. Right? So this would be an example of exocytosis. And moving all of these major cellular components around, do you think that requires ATP or not? You know what? It does. It's active transport. All right? It's active transport. Yeah, so is bulk transport a form of passive or active transport?
Passive.
Just say active, yeah. It requires ATP. All right, membrane potential. We can also call this a membrane voltage. Anytime you see this term potential, you should probably think of a voltage. All right, and so I'm not sure you've thought of voltages ever. So I got a couple questions for you. What devices do you own that contain a voltage? A battery. Where do you have a battery? Cell phone? Car? MP3 player? Okay, have batteries. All right, and how many terminals does a battery have? I don't know if you've ever looked at a battery. Probably some people have looked at a battery. How many terminals does a battery have? It's got two terminals, right? Certainly on your car, if you need to charge the battery on your car or get started, you got to hook up, what, two wires to it because it's got two terminals. One is a plus and one is a minus, or one is a plus and one is a ground. The ground just means that it's minus, but it's always got two terminals associated with it. Okay, so here is, let's look at this. This is a cell right here, and, well, I tell you what, let's go back to here. What does a battery do? What is it doing? All right, so we said that it has two terminals, so one is always going to be positive with respect to the other. A battery separates out charge. It separates charge, positive charges from negative charges. So a way of thinking of that is that you have a gradient of charge. Right, and what can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract, right? So if you connect the two terminals up together, those charges will attract each other, they'll neutralize each other, the gradient of charge will go away. Remember that sodium gradient? What is one way to think of a sodium gradient? It can be used in lieu of ATP. A gradient of sodium is really what? Energy. Right? What's a gradient of electrical charge? What is it really? It's really energy, just like a sodium gradient is, right? But it just has a little bit different nature because it has electrical charge on it. All right? So batteries are really a storage form of energy, right? Because it separates charge. Okay. All right, so here is a living cell, and there is a difference of charge across the membrane. So if we take a voltmeter that has two little probes on it, just like you could measure voltage on a battery, we could stick a voltmeter and stick one probe inside the cell and one probe outside the cell and measure a voltage across this membrane right here. So how maybe should you think of every cell in your body? It's actually a battery. Every cell in your body acts like a battery. And now we're going to investigate how that happens and how your cells can use that energy for various things. Okay. Well, there are many large molecules inside the cell, like chromosomes and proteins, are way too large to leak out, and they're negatively charged. They're all negatively charged. They can't leak out, and your body builds them all the time. And they're stuck inside the cell. Okay. There is a cation, namely potassium. It can diffuse from outside to inside. Because there are channels. Potassium can't move across the membrane because it's a charged particle. It's hydrophilic. Don't forget, this membrane right here is hydrophobic. The only way potassium can enter the cell is because there's a pathway, there's a protein that allows it to go through. All right? So, in this particular case, why does potassium enter the cell? Yeah, because you have all these negative charges right here. So there is electrical attraction that's pulling potassium inside the cell. All right. Sodium is not very permeable, and actually it's kicked out of the cell. So when a positive sodium ion gets pushed out of the cell, can you see that the cell gets even a little bit more negative, right? If the cell is losing positivity, it's becoming more negative on the inside. All right. So the membrane potential at a cell at rest is negative inside the cell compared to the outside. Okay, and the place to start is because of what we call these fixed anions. What is an anion again? It's a negatively charged particle, ion that can't leave the cell. Okay. All right, so this sort of explains a couple things, but we need to talk about this a little bit more. So here is that voltmeter. And we put one electrode outside the cell and one inside. And if this is a living cell, it's not going to read zero.
it's going to read minus 90 millivolts. That's actually a pretty large voltage. Okay, meaning that it's more negative inside the cell. All right, so let's look at this equilibrium potential. All right, so since potassium can enter the cell, this positive charge is being attracted by these negative charges. Right, so they will neutralize each other. But as potassium concentration inside the cell increases, potassium is high on the inside and low on the outside because it's being attracted by these anions, which way does potassium want to diffuse? It wants to diffuse out because of the concentration gradient. So there are two forces acting on potassium. One is to draw it inside the cell. That's the electrical attraction. The other force is trying to boot potassium out of the cell. And that's what? The concentration gradient is trying to kick potassium out. So eventually there's going to be an equilibrium established so potassium doesn't move in nor out. And in that particular case, what's balanced is the electrical attraction, or potassium moving into the cell, is exactly balanced by the amount of potassium diffusing out according to the concentration gradient. Right? And that's what we call the equilibrium potential. So if the membrane, so I have a couple little things I have to say in order to understand that, and that is if the membrane is permeable only to potassium, okay, but don't forget there's other ions associated with the cell like chlorine and sodium and calcium. We'll look at those in the next couple slides, but let's pretend there's only potassium, right? If the membrane is permeable only to potassium, it would diffuse in until it reaches this equilibrium potential that we call E sub K. At that point, potassium is attracted inside by the trapped ions, but it's also driven out by the concentration gradient. This equilibrium right here is a balance between the electrical and diffusion forces. At equilibrium, they are what? They're equal but exactly opposite to each other. Okay? And when that happens, that produces a voltage that's about minus 90 millivolts inside the cell compared to outside the cell. So you can't bring in enough potassium to balance out all these electrical charges, right? You still have some leftover electrical charge inside the cell that produces this membrane potential. Right? And the reason why can't you bring in enough potassium to completely electrically neutralize all of these fixed anions inside the cell? Because as the concentration builds up inside the cell, then you have too much diffusion taking place, right? So it's balanced out right at minus 90 millivolts. So all cells in your body do that. All right, if we were to measure the electricity across the membrane of all your cells, all right, you would see it'd be negative on the inside compared to the outside. So what does every cell in your body act like? Battery. You got trillions of batteries that operate your living processes. Right, and we're going to look at how that happens really pretty much through the remainder of the class. You're not going to see exactly how that works. You're just seeing how the battery nature develops on a particular cell. Okay, and there is an equation that we can use to calculate that equilibrium potential. This equation works only for one ion at a time. And what are some important ions? You got potassium, you got sodium, you got chlorine, and as well as calcium. Those are the four major kinds of ions. So if we want to calculate the equilibrium potential, we have to use four different equations, okay, to measure what the overall effect would be. So the Nernst equation only works for one ion at a time. And what does it give us? It gives us the membrane voltage, or you could say membrane potential, needed to counteract the concentration forces acting on an ion across the membrane. And the value, what does that value of the equilibrium potential depend on? It's just the ratio of concentrations inside and outside the cell, as well as the charge on that particular ion. So here is the Nernst equation. It's really easy to calculate. We just have this number. This is just a number, a proportionality constant, divided by Z, and Z is the valence of some particular ion. So for sodium, what's the valence? What's the charge? It's plus, but what's the magnitude of that charge? It's 1. So Z in this particular case, this is the simplest case, would be equal to 1. So what's 61 divided by 1? It's 61. So that's really easy. But some ions, for instance, like calcium, what can you tell me about calcium? Calcium ion. It's a cation, but it's also a what? A divalent cation. So for Z, what would you put for Z right here? It would be 2. And as a matter of fact, you put plus 2. So I don't know what 61 divided by 2 is. That's a weird number. All right, it's another fraction. All right, so that's what Z stands for. And then the X right here, we have to take the log of the concentration in molarity of that ion outside the cell compared and divide it by the concentration inside the cell. And then we could calculate what the voltage is across the cell according to the concentration of that particular ion outside the cell and inside the cell. And that's really easy to do. So here's that Nernst equation once again. So what goes in? What goes into this numerator right here? That's the outside concentration, and in the denominator is the inside concentration. That's the hardest thing to remember in the whole equation, right? Outside to inside. So here we have a cell, and here are those four main ions that we have, and those are what? Sodium, potassium, chlorine, calcium. How would you talk about the ionic nature of this chlorine right here? What kind of ion is it? It's an anion. What kind of anion? Yeah, we call that a monovalent anion. Monovalent. I think I went over monovalent, bivalent, trivalent. And what about calcium? That is a divalent what? That's a cation. I drew a face of the cat right on the board for you, right? So divalent cation. So this plus 2 would be equal, if we're calculating calcium, would be what? Put in for the Z. What would we use for Z if it was chlorine? You'd use a minus 1 right here. Okay? And for sodium and potassium, it would just be 1. All right. Well, this is for a normal cell at rest. Where is sodium higher? Inside or outside? Outside. And you see the concentration, so you could plug the concentrations into this equation and calculate the voltage. All right? Where is potassium high? Inside the cell. All right? And that's because potassium is sees the most this membrane is most permeable to potassium. So since there are a lot of negative charges inside the cell, pretty much only potassium can enter. Plus, don't forget that sodium potassium ATP pump is pumping potassiums in all the time. All right. So if you take these concentrations, plug it into this equation, what would you use for Z? For potassium? Plus 1. All right, and then take the log of the concentration of potassium, you would get the voltage that's produced across this membrane according to just the potassium ion. All right, chlorine. Where's chlorine high? Outside the cell. Right, and don't forget, Z would be minus 1 right here. So here is inside. You put this number here. 125 is outside. Put it here. Divide the 2. Take the log. All right, multiply it by minus 61. And that would be the voltage according to this Nernst equation. All right, and then calcium. Where is calcium high? Outside the cell, right? Outside the cell. All right, so on this particular illustration, what do I want you to know? I want you to know for sure where is sodium high? Where is potassium high? Where is chlorine high? Where is calcium high? I don't want you to memorize the molar or millimolar concentrations. All right, that's too much memorization. But I do want you to know, on a living cell, where do you find high sodium? Is it outside or inside? And for potassium, is it high or inside? Same thing for chlorine and calcium. All right, so I don't know a nice trick to memorize that, but hopefully it's not too bad. Right, but on the test, maybe I'll have you calculate a voltage if I give you the concentrations. All right, so that's a requirement. You got to bring a calculator in. Okay. Yeah, you have. That's one of that's on the syllabus. Yeah, I'd give you the formula. Okay, concentrations. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, say a little bit louder. Yeah? Well, yeah, let's look at the, what can you tell me about the gradient? Is the gradient the same for potassium and sodium? It is what? It's opposite. Okay. What about the Z right here? What about the valence? Does it change?
No.
It's the same. So Z stays the same, but the concentration is gradient. So for potassium, you end up with a negative voltage. But since it's an opposite gradient for sodium, it turns out to be a positive voltage, right? Yeah, you can trust that calculation. Okay, so know which one is high inside. And look, here's an example for you. All right, what's 5 and 150? Do I have 5 and 150? Oh yeah, here's 5 outside. Here's 150 inside. Set up like that. That equals minus 90 millivolts. You can check your calculator. See if it's working properly. It's got to have what to work properly?
Battery.
It's got to have battery. That's right. It needs energy. It needs a separation of charge. It needs a charge gradient, right?
Was that equal? What was that number?
I'm sorry?
The negative 90.
The minus 90 right here? This is the equilibrium potential due to this difference of potassium across the membrane. Okay? And don't forget, this plus 1 comes from the valence of potassium. It's just a plus 1. And what is potassium outside the cell? It's 5 millimolar. What is it inside the cell? It's 150 millimolar right here. So try punching that out on your calculator. You have to divide first before you take the log. You can't take the log of 5 and then divide by 150. So there should be a nice parentheses right here. And what you see for sodium is what? The gradient is opposite, so what about the voltage? It's opposite as well, okay, as a result of that. Okay, and so don't forget, how many ions can you calculate the equilibrium potential for at one time?
One.
Only one, and you got to pick what it is, right? It can only be potassium, or it can only be sodium, or it can only be chlorine at one time. Okay, so let's see, when did we start? 3 to 4? 4:30.
20.
Okay, yeah, 20. Okay. All right, so you know what? We're not going to get through this today. So I got to postpone the test. Now, I know some of you might really hate me for doing that. Okay? Because I really hate, I don't know if somebody has really arranged their schedule already, but I'm going to have to postpone the test until a week from today. So it's going to be Wednesday of next week, right? Is it Wednesday today? It's got to be Wednesday instead of Monday. All right, so but I'll only postpone it if we stay in class the whole class period. We can't leave early.
Yeah.
All right, so I still want to keep talking about this, but so if somebody has a terrible problem with me switching the exam day around, you have to talk to me, okay? All right, so on Monday, make sure if you have any questions on the quantitative questions at the end of the chapter, you know, you've got to talk to me about that. Or your lab instructor, they should know how to set up all those questions for you. All right, but that gives you like a couple more hours to study the material. All right, but I need to talk about some more stuff. And I can only talk so fast about this stuff, otherwise it just goes right over my head. Okay. So sorry to those people that have lab on Wednesday. Probably people that have lab on Monday really like to hear that news. Okay. All right, so let's get back to the lecture so far. All right, so don't forget, you got to know what ions are high on the inside, high on the outside. All right, the resting, and so if we add all of these voltages up together, when you have a cell at rest, there is what we call the resting membrane potential. And I'll probably be talking about RMP for the rest of the class almost every day. All right, so when I say RMP, you're just going to think
resting membrane potential.
That's the voltage from the inside of the membrane to the outside of the membrane when the cell is at rest, right? And
That means that the cell can't be producing electrical impulses, which nerves like to do, and muscles. All right, so RMP in most cells is about minus 65 to minus 85 millivolts, so typically we say about minus 70 is a good ballpark number. So RMP, what does RMP depend on? The concentration difference of all those different ions that we looked at, right? So it depends on concentrations of ions, all the ions inside and outside the cell, but it also depends on something else, and that is the permeability of each of these ions. The most permeable is potassium. Potassium can move across the membrane the easiest because there are channels that don't close. We call these leak channels. They're open all the time. All right, so the resting membrane potential is due to what? Here's that voltmeter again. Right, so we see that it's negative on the inside of the cell. This mostly develops because of all these fixed anions inside the cell. Potassium can leak out. When potassium leaks out, can you see that that adds to the negativity of the cell when the positive charge leaves? All right. Some sodium diffuses in, and when sodium diffuses in, what happens to the membrane potential? Sodium, don't forget, is positive. Inside is negative, right? So when positive goes in, it has a tendency to neutralize some of the negative charge inside the cell. All right, and what I'm going to tell you is that if you add up all of the equilibrium potentials for all these ions right here, you see that it doesn't add up. And that's why I'm trying to show you that we just can't add up these voltages. Like, for instance, if the membrane potential was due only to potassium and sodium, you would expect that the membrane, the RMP, would be what? Minus 30 millivolts, right? But that's not what we see, right? So I wanted to describe why we don't see exactly what you calculate right here. One of the reasons why is because sodium leaks in a little bit. So that means that you can't add things up. The other thing is, what about that sodium-potassium pump? It's not equal, right? Because it's pumping two potassiums in for three sodiums out, right? We call that electrogenic, right? So if it's pumping two positive charges in and three positive charges out, what's eventually going to develop inside the cell? It's going to become a little bit more negative because this sodium-potassium pump is pumping out more positive charges than it's pumping in. So that makes RMP a little bit more negative, right? So that's another minus 3 millivolts right there. All right, so here is, this is not an exam figure, but this kind of shows how we get to explain why RMP is about minus 70 millivolts. Well, where do we start? First, all those negative charges inside the cell, right? We have unequal permeabilities. Sodium and potassium are different. So you have more potassium leaking in, less sodium leaking in. Right? You've got the electrogenic pump, which is pumping more positive charges outside the cell. That makes the inside a little bit more negative. Right? And we also have an uneven distribution of ions across the membrane. We have potassium, we have sodium, and what are two other important ones? Chlorine and calcium, right? So they also add to the resting membrane potential. And if we add up all the effects of all of the ions and this pump right here and the unequal permeabilities of the various ions of the resting cell membrane, we actually can end up with minus 70 millivolts. All right, so this is what we're going to see in a normal, typical cell, minus 70 millivolts. All right, so next time, I think I'm going to start right here, cell signaling. Oh, you know I could have finished up today. That's okay. So I can take some questions. Look, you got to look at that a bunch over the weekend and start looking at some questions. Right, you got to work with that information somehow. All right? Okay.